Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I'm your host, Aaron Roller, and I'm here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
I am here. I have to tell you, I never know what to say now.
You always say something.
Right.
So yeah. It seems to work itself out pretty well.
Yeah, I guess so.
But it seems like you find yourself in a bind.
Yes, very good. This is the binding of
the binding of Isaac.
And binding of Isaac.
That's right, because it's Parshat Vayera. We are. Oh, it seems like Bereishit is just moving so quickly.
It's wild. It really is. There's something like Vayikra. Just the parshas just blend into one another, and you know whatever given parsha you're in Vayikra and Bamidbar doesn't, or Devarim even, doesn't seem to matter all that much, but. When they're more narrative, it flies. Like, wow, we're already there.
Yeah. Well, and especially this week, because I feel like our conversation is going to really pick up a lot of the stuff we talked about last week. Last week, for new listeners, we talked about the tests, the idea that Abraham is tested, that he has 10 tests, is sort of like this idea which lives in our tradition, and why that should be the case, and what tests... Like why Abraham is tested, and sort of what that should tell us about tests in our own lives, the way he handles them, the way we deal. And in this week's parsha, we get the ultimate tenth and ultimate test, the binding of Isaac, the command that he should slaughter his son with his wife Sarah, and it is it's
with his wife Sarah. Is that what you said?
The son that he has, he has another son. This is mirroring the Rashi early on,
right?
When he's commanded, right? He goes, "Well, you have
sacrifice
son,
your
have,
son. Which son?
I have two sons. The one you love. I love them both.
Right?
So,
firstborn. They're both firstborns.
Yep. Yitzhak, go sacrifice Yitzhak. So one thing I was noticing is just that the way that this week's parsha is so full of parent-child relationships. And I don't, on one hand, I guess, thinking about the other parshiot, they all are, really? I mean, it's almost like an unnoticed theme, and maybe it's not even a theme, it's just we're telling family stories. But just think about it. We've got the announcement that Avraham and Sarah are going to have a child, which comes as a bit
very
of...
Very beginning, right.
Certainly a... I love the laughter of Sarah, the idea that it... Like, is it funny?
Well, and also that it mirrors the laughter in last week's parsha, right? When Avraham hears about it, he does the same, although...
He doesn't get any flack for it.
Right. And in fact, he's told that it's specifically for that reason that the child's name ought to be Yitzchak, which is really the only instance that we have in the Torah of I believe, of God telling the parent what the name should be.
Hmm. Interesting. But Sheila, I just like the idea, like, that this sort of like paradigm of laughter as not humor, but rather as just the unexpected.
Which makes it all the more jarring to be told that this is the son that you have to sacrifice. Meaning that there's so much behind this. There's so much miracle, and there's so much drama, and there's so much anticipation. Either anticipation or look, they're hoping for a child. And yet it gets to a point where I suppose they just don't believe, at least not at the very forefront of their consciousness, that it's really going to happen. So when God says it's going to happen, it produces and elicits laughter because it's just such an about face. And it's almost, it becomes so on the face of it, right? If you were going to question God, it feels so almost maniacal. Like you didn't have to perform this miracle. You didn't have to provide us with this child just to get our hopes up, just to say that he now is going to be sacrificed, which makes the sacrifice and which makes the demand and makes the strain that much more real and that much more pronounced.
As readers, I think that it becomes real to us in this, like, it's, there's like a heightened dramatic irony, right? Like, I think every parent must have the experience, must share the experience of looking in at their sleeping child just to check that they're breathing. You know, that this child should live. That you know, every child feels like a miracle or like a something that would elicit the laughter of, I can't believe that this this person has come into being, right? I think everybody feels that. And yet, and Avraham and Sarah and what they're going through, they just feel it all the more so because they're not people in the prime of life who are surprised, despite their fertility. They're surprised because of their infertility, because of their advanced age, because they think that this should not be in the card. So the idea that it's so clearly a miracle, the idea that this is something which was foretold by angels, and then God is going to up and take it away, is so. It seems cruel. It seems perverse, and it is not only the fact that this hoped for future, this hoped for offspring and a sign of continuity and continuing the mission and the vision. It's also the collapse of faith in God. I think that when we talk about this a lot, and this sort of is just occurring to me now, we talk about it as like on a very philosophical level of like God is saying like, I'm going to give you a challenge which you know seems to go against your sense of morality. But it's not just, you know, if you're Avraham, I think it's not just that it goes against my sense of morality. It's that God, I like, you're acting in a way that I would never have imagined that you would act.
Right. It's not just a moral challenge. It's a theological challenge.
Right. But theological, not in the sense, not in an abstract sense, but in like a God, you said this, like,
right.
I recognize that everything that happens comes from God, and all the more so, this thing is very, very clearly from God.
Which, if you're trying to test somebody's utter, complete, blind faith in God, and their insistence that whatever might be going through a human being's mind can never fully comprehend whatever it is that God has in his mind, this is perfect. I mean, it's the perfect test. It's going to be personally painful. There is nothing like you mentioned, whatever it is that evokes that concern or that fear or that paranoia, let me just go in and take a peek and make sure that they're still breathing. There's that element of it. There's just the visceral desire and interest of caring for a child as a parent. And there's that element. There's the element of Avraham fighting against and preaching against human sacrifice for his entire career as a preacher and as a monotheist about how it's wrong and respecting every individual and the Tselem Elokim, every person is created in the image of God, and the evils of human sacrifice. So you have that element. And then there's this theological dimension of this just doesn't make sense that God, you've shown so much. Meaning it's one thing for us to just say very plainly, well, we don't understand God. There's no way for us to understand God. We just don't get him. But Avraham has traveled so far down that path of understanding God. He has such a close and personal relationship with him. God has revealed himself to Avraham to such a great degree that you begin to believe that you really have a handle. And then it's just to find out that I guess I really don't. In the final analysis, God is exactly who Avraham expected him to be, but that he was actually prepared to make the sacrifice and prepared to say that even if I completely was misled and I misunderstood and nothing that I thought I knew I really knew, I'm still willing to follow you and I'm still willing to follow your commandment. It's just the most, it really becomes just the most, you couldn't script a better means of testing Avraham's faith.
I think it's heightened also by the fact that we get another, I think, paradigmatic defining episode in Judaism with Avraham's protest on behalf of the people of Sodom, right? He says, like, you know, Avraham makes the argument to God that there has to be some sort of moral order to the universe, that
right.
the innocent shouldn't be punished along with the guilty. So, you know, I think that if anything is going to demonstrate for us that Avraham has this faith and has this sense of understanding God is a just God, you know, it's that. It's just a few, you know, just a few aliyot earlier, not much earlier. So how? So is that in your reading? Is that the purpose of it that, like, the combination of that, sometimes it seems that God will ask us to do things that we don't understand and we have to do them. However, ultimately, it will never be that bad. We'll never actually have to cross a line, or like,
I don't know that we'll never have to cross a line. That God constructs the lines, and that things that can be really painful and really troublesome and really confusing, nevertheless, may be areas that I need to be areas that in which I'm being tested, right? Need to be areas in which I rise to the challenge as opposed to, see, it's very different for Abraham in the sense that Abraham didn't have, you know, there was no text to look down to
he had no Abraham to look at.
He had no Abraham to look at, and he had no written institutionalized moral code. He had no Gemara. He really had no. As much as we say that Abraham studied Torah and there was some sort of revelation, you know, to these very very early prophets, they're not formalized in any which way. Such that if God says that, see, what would happen today if God said, you know, go sacrifice a human being? We would say, well, you know, I don't know about that individual prophecy or that individual
or you check yourself into the right. Psychiatric ward.
Well, now we certainly would, but I mean, even in the era of nevuah, even in the era of prophecy, there is an institutionalized moral code that God has presented us with, and first and foremost, that's what we judge everything up against. And because Abraham doesn't have that, it's a matter of, listen, this is how I've always perceived of you, and this is how I always understood you, and now you're asking me to do something that's going to make me think of you in a totally, totally different way. Or I don't even know if that's the case, meaning that this somehow or another, this is supposed to exist in this bubble. Like, does Avram's view of God, or will Avram's view of God change after this happens? I don't think so. I think it's that Abraham somehow or another needs to square this act away with God is still kind and compassionate. Somehow or another, this is an act of his kindness and compassion and of his mercy. And I don't get it and I don't understand it, but I don't think that Abraham would walk away from the Akedah, even if he was successful in sacrificing his son, as saying, I guess I was wrong. God is actually vengeful, or God is actually bloodthirsty. And now that changes my impression of him, that changes how I define him, and therefore it also changes my work, and it changes my ambassadorship, and it changes how I'm going to convey his word and his will to other people, because I was wrong about what his will was. I don't think so. I think Abraham would need to spend the rest of his life continuing to say that God is merciful and kind, and I don't understand how every one of his acts is merciful and kind. And that's what I mean when I say that I don't know that there's a line that we don't cross, meaning I do think that there are plenty of instances, personally and nationally, where we've looked around and have said, if there's a kind, merciful, compassionate God running the show here, then I'm just missing it. And what we need to be able to do is somehow or another compartmentalize those feelings and recognize that it doesn't really change fundamentally who God is and what he's about.
I mean, I think that's like a, I wonder, I mean, I wonder if our readers are going to, our listeners are would weigh in on this. But to me, I feel like you just articulated Orthodox Judaism, like what makes Orthodox Judaism orthodoxy so well, this idea that like we hold in a concept of God in our minds, and we also hold the traditions and the details of the laws, and usually or often they're mutually reinforcing, but there are times when those things don't square, but we put the sort of the laws and the traditions ahead of kind of our the sort of the philosophical picture that we've painted for ourselves and say we don't see how these fit into the picture, but they're in there, basically. I mean, to take it like in a you know, probably a way more mundane kind of direction, what I think about is like, is Kirov, is outrage, right? Like the, you know, I mean, I'd not go through this myself, but you sort of hear the stories about like, oh, you know, the Chabad Shliach or the Eshat Torah program or whatever it was, they made it sound like Shabbos was going to be amazing. They made it sound like, you know, or Shabbos at their table was, you know, was always a beautiful thing. And there were 25 people there and they were learning new songs and everyone's getting turned on and all that. We have this vision of Avraham as like this great Kiruv rabbi. He's bringing people into his tent and he's telling them how wonderful God is and the reality of all, you know, and this is the truth that you should follow, that should inform your life. To your point, I think you would imagine that in so doing, you know, somebody would come in and say, well, I've had a really difficult life. Oh, God has a plan for you. You know, there's something at the end of this, or there's some sense that it makes, or it tested you in a certain way. And, you know, maybe Avram would say, I've been tested too. You know, he probably would, you know, you can imagine him cracking a smile. When I got here, there was a famine and I had to leave and go to Egypt. Ha ha ha. You know, and it becomes this like ordeal that you can joke about. But like, this is where it's not, I think exactly to your point, it's not that this was never part of his conception. Like the idea that there's going to be challenges in life, the idea that God is going to ask you to do things you don't understand is probably part of it. And yet, this is like where the rubber hits the road.
Meaning it's not a difference in kind, it's a difference in degree.
Yeah.
Meaning every one of Avraham's tests has created a difficulty in which it was challenging to actually see God's plan. Although the truth is, in many of those instances, there was that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I don't know why God is sending me here just for there to be a famine so that I'll have to leave, but he comes back laden with riches.
Right, and he sends Ishmael away, but Ishmael ultimately ends up okay, and he told you, you know, he's told you have to send him away, but he's going to be okay. He's going to become the father of a nation.
And I think that's what's so challenging about the Akedah is that I think real life sometimes works this way, and history and Jewish history really works this way sometimes, that even the entire arc of Jewish history itself isn't always long enough for us to be able to look back and say, oh, that's why that happened, and that's why it makes sense. I don't know why it is that the Holocaust had to happen, but I know that it's not a stain on God's resume, on the compassionate, all-loving, kind, and merciful God. I know that I can't square it away and I don't understand it, but it neither changes my perception of God, nor does it mean that God just wasn't there or was overcome or was overwhelmed when it happened, that somehow or another, those two can coexist. God is perfect, he's all-loving, and yet there are unspeakable things that can take place that somehow or another still fit into that picture.
I don't know when you stopped listening, paying attention to the songs on the radio. Do you remember the Mighty Mighty Bosstones though? They were a ska. They were like a ska, like, you know, kind of like a Jamaican sort of beat from Boston. Anyway, they had this song. They're one big hit.
Did you say ska?
Ska, S-K-A. That was like a...
What does that mean?
It was like a sort of a reggae-influenced beat that was picked up first by English musicians with, like, when there were Jamaican immigrants in England. So Jamaican and English musicians came together in bands like The Specials, adopting sort of an English reggae beat with pop songs. And then it came to America and it kind of got mixed with the punk movement. None of this is important to my point.
This is all fascinating.
Yeah. Well, listen, check out The Specials. They are excellent. But the point is that they had this hit called The Impression That I Get, which was kind of about like bad things happening. And there was this line. It was like, you know, like knocking on wood, like you knock wood, like the bad thing shouldn't happen. It was like, well, it doesn't matter what the chorus was. There was this line in the song that was, I'm not a coward. I've just never been tested. I'd like to think that if I was, I would pass. Uh-huh. And that's, I mean, you know, it's a pretty, it's kind of an obscure reference, you know, unless you grew up exactly when I did and were listening to the radio that summer. But I think that's kind of the sentiment here, that it not like, maybe it's not that the vision of God is totally rosy and no one's should be. It's just that like you can go most of your life sort of living in fear of like, I don't know what's going to happen when bad things happen. I don't know if, you know, will this shake my faith? Will I be able to withstand it? Will I be able to do what needs to be done at that time? Well, I know what needs to be done, right? There's definitely, I don't think it's a Jewish strain. We were talking about Kierkegaard before we started recording, Soren Kierkegaard. What country was he from? I don't know, Dutch, Swedish? Anyway, philosopher. But he wrote a whole book, Fear and Trembling, about the Akedah, you know, arguing that maybe Abraham passing the test would have been resisting God. That God's telling you to do something which is immoral. You know, that maybe the greater victory would have been to stand up for morality, for God's morality, so to speak, to remind God what he really stands for. It doesn't strike one as a particularly it's not certainly not from the text, but on a very deep human level there's a sympathy with that idea, even though it doesn't ring true to what we know about Jewish tradition and the way we look at these things in you know, both in the text and writ large. But there's a resonance to like what's the right thing to do here. But and yet we see that Abraham does, and what we see that is called his victory is him waking up early in the morning to go carry out the word of God, to have this faith that if God gave him this, then either it's God's to take away this child that he wanted with all his heart, or that God has a greater plan and it's going to be okay. And then that's even just talking about it, it's such a difficult line to walk. And yet that's what happens. It's really, it's powerful, and it's one of these moments that resonates for all of history, all of Jewish history. It factors its way into the way I think we see the world and we go through life.
I think it needs to. I mean, it's such a critical, to me, it's such a critical component of what we are in terms of this dynamic, this relationship that exists between God and man. I find the idea of there being some moral code that I'm meant to defend almost apart from God, very, very troubling. Very troubling. Now, what's interesting is that, look, you, to some degree, you do see God. You do see Abraham make that pitch to God and have that debate with God, and you see Moshe do it to some degree later on in history. There are those moments when individuals are meant to stand up and say, you know, God, I don't think so. To me, what proves the point here with this final test is that we know that Abraham has a track record of arguing with God. And here he's convinced that that's not correct, that that's not what God is asking of him.
Maybe because it's so... It's so far beyond what he can possibly comprehend.
Right.
There's no.
It's like, one thing for God to say, look, Abraham, I'm going to kill a lot of people who deserve to die. What do you think about that? And Abraham says, well, I think I get it. I think I get what you want me to think about that. What you want me to think about that is that if you're going to kill all these people who deserve to die, is it possible that there might be one or more who doesn't deserve to die? And if somebody righteous was even able to grow up in their midst, maybe really none of them deserve to die. Maybe they should have some credit for at least creating the sort of culture that allowed for that one person to survive and to thrive. But this doesn't make any sense. This is just, there's no way to interpret this other than you're clearly asking me to do something that is against everything that I know and everything that I believe in. Here, the only answer is to actually submit. And that's what he does. And I think there are moments of passion, and there are moments of doing, and there are moments of creating, and there are also moments of submission. And Avram serves as a very important, critical, and I think first of its kind role model in both regards, both when we're supposed to be passionate and when we're supposed to build and supposed to create and we're supposed to sort of feel like we're walking almost in front of God, right, doing his work on his behalf or serving as his ambassador. God, I know exactly what you want me to do here, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to do your work for you. And sometimes just not really getting it, but just walking, you know, passively with bowed head and submission.
It's I think that's one of the challenges, is to know when to walk that line, when is the challenge, and when to submit. But I don't think that's an easy. I don't think that's an easy message for the Shabbos table. But I think that's maybe one of the key lessons of Avraham Avinu, and one of the key lessons of this parsha is that there's that we're not meant. God doesn't intend for us to walk through the world like moral idiots, just saying, well, this must be what God wants, or oh, this terrible thing happened. It must be God's will. There's definitely a time and a place to stand up and to either respond or to challenge, and then there's times to unfortunately, painful as it may be, to kind of stand back in awe and in submission of what is happening, and to be a part of that, or to follow what God is telling you, as much as it may hurt, and knowing knowing when to do that is our challenge, and we have to just to give it a thoroughly religious message, probably through learning Torah and through, you know, understanding God's will as much as possible is the key to finding the space in between those things, is what I would think.
Yeah, I think in that regard we really do have a leg up in some regard, in the sense that it's
over Avraham.
Well, I just mean in the sense that it's no longer as amorphous as it was before the Torah was given. There's an awful lot of debate, and there's an awful lot of interpretation and counterinterpretation, all within the realm of appropriate halacha. But we do have a code, and sometimes that code doesn't feel right and it doesn't resonate. But I think that what Avraham is showing us, what this final test is showing us, is that doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that it hurts.
And on that down note, the Portion podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid Znigin by Simply Tzvat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us, leave a review, and you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.